Well, hello and welcome to the ANF podcast from the ANF Network with me, Al Coates,
me, Scott Casson-Rennie.
And we've got a guest. So, hello, guest.
Dr. Michael Lambert.
Dr. Michael Lambert. There was a bit of confusion earlier where we thought you might be a professor for a moment, but that was fleeting. But you're definitely a doctor, so that's all very good.
Depends how this goes. I'm not ruling out professorship just yet.
Oh, he's got our number already.
He's a step ahead of us all the way. And this year has been a really interesting year in terms of groups of people looking for an adoption apology. And so we invited Dr. Michael on if you could introduce who you are, and then we're going to do some news and then we'll get into the guts of it. So tell us who you are, what your full title is, what your PhD is in, and why are you talking about adoption?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm afraid it's not got a nice soundbitey answer. So I'm currently a research fellow and director of widening participation in Lancaster Medical School. But it's really the research that I did on my PhD that's led me here. So I ended up looking at social work and the history of children and family services in England, primarily between 1940 and 1970. And it was in trying to unearth how and why policies were made, enacted, developed, using social work case files, and then tracing those through to local authorities, voluntary organizations, and then through to central government, and in some cases, international organizations. It's by encountering forced adoption in the archival record that then led me into the route where, when the inquiry was calling for evidence, that I had plenty of that, even though that wasn't what I started out looking for.
Right.
And I felt in a position to be able to contribute based on that.
All right. I mean, it's quite a niche, it feels like a niche issue, like that specific period, social work between those periods. What kind of drew you into that?
It's mainly the way the welfare state operated at that time. It's just a set of legislative dates, you know, and I mean to be a convenient shorthand for anything else, that there was a period of time where it was very, very stable almost. So it's before the British Association of Social Workers was created in 1970, when there were lots of different streams feeding into it. And there were a lot of older government structures in how they ran and did services. And in sort of between 1917, 1974 and 78, there were an enormous series of changes where that older welfare state, which had been in existence for about 25 years, it just all completely unraveled and changed. And it was that moment in time that I was really exploring, because the sort of consequences of that for now are quite significant in the changes that it then unleashed. And so, yes, it is quite niche, but it's detailed.
Well, I mean, we are going down a bit of a rabbit hole here, but when I did my social work degree, we studied law, which was part of that. And one bit of that was we went right back to the beginning, which was some things like the 1948 National Assistance Act, which is still hovering around. This is really niche, isn't it? But it matters.
Yeah. Absolutely. It matters. When you're trying to unpick and unravel where responsibility lies and where where and why and when things happened and how they did the way they did, that kind of granular level detail, understanding what it meant for people's lives, I think is the key. And it's those stories through. So that was the source of information I had. It wasn't sort of, I mean, I came to policy documents and stuff later. It was people's lives through social work case files. It was thousands of those that I was going through, reading, understanding, and how and why decisions were made about their lives.
Because we are really going into the long grass here, but there's a story in my family that relates to the 1948 National Assistance Act. My dad's dad died in 1948, and my grandmother had to go, and she had three children, no money, and she had to go to a National Assistance Board and ask for money for shoes, and it cast such a shadow over everything that happened afterwards, because she was just so embarrassed and ashamed that she'd said, I think there were like 10 people who'd grilled her about why she couldn't afford shoes, and just, you know, her husband had died, and it's just, so that stuff's really interesting because it's still around, isn't it? It's still in the DNA of lots of families.
Absolutely. It lurks underneath. I suppose once you start exploring your personal family's histories, those kinds of stories are far more common than I think people might realize. And then understanding the whole kind of apparatus that lay behind that incredibly stigmatizing decision-making is exactly the kind of thing that I've been looking into.
Smashing. So before we get on to adoption apology and policy, I have a couple of news items that I'd like you to comment on, Dr. Michael. and Scott to comment on. So we have just had the news that we have got a new children's minister. What do you think about that then, Scott? We've got a new minister, came on board. He is David Johnson.
Now, can I just preface this part of the conversation? Because for some bizarre reason, I'm not on social media as much as I used to be. And clearly, as I live in a different country, I don't actually see a lot of UK, England's news. So I did hear about this, and you've obviously put it on our little thing that we circulate. So this is the 10th minister since 2012.
Yeah. And I think so the seventh since 2015.
What's going on? Why has nobody in their right mind decided? Oh, I don't know. All I'll say is I didn't notice he got an OBE for something. I can't remember what it was now. That seemed quite relevant, but oh, for goodness sake. For services to social mobility and education, which is lovely. But is he going to be here in a couple of weeks' time? Who knows? I'm not normally critical of stuff like this, but since he kicked me off the adopter reference group, I'm just going for the kill. Come on, guys, sort your shizzle out, because you know the last one was only there for less than a couple of months, and
like Cahino,
you know,
Coutinho,
yeah. I don't know.
Now,
what can you say?
Well, you can't say anything. I mean, it's a mockery. No. Let's ask Dr. Michael, because are you allowed to be political, Dr. Michael?
To a point. Yeah, please don't call me Dr. Michael all the time, you know? I mean, I'll call you Professor then.
I'll say Professor Michael.
Yeah, maybe I'll stick in the university, I'll listen. What do I think? I look forward, hopefully, to not receiving the same boilerplate answer from the minister time and again, asking the same question about trying to push an apology. I've done that personally directly through other kinds of routes, and the standard reply has been pretty dismal, and the engagement has been not forthcoming, to put it politely. So I will be optimistic with the kind of background that he comes through. You know, he's from the industry and things like sociability education. That's through the social market or mobility foundation. He was there for a few years, wasn't he? That he come through that route, so you hope he'd have a recognition for the kinds of issues involved. But am I optimistic? Not enormously.
I think it is quite interesting. I think because we've had so many, now it just seems like they slot them into this. You know, it just seems like the, you know,
stepping stone.
I think Ed Timpson, I think, was really the last children's minister that I view as making an impact. Since then, it's just been one after the other after the other. You know, we had one that was there literally a couple of weeks and then disappeared. We actually had Will Quince on, was it October, November last time
summer.
Last year, wasn't it?
Last summer.
And then, you know, literally 2 weeks later, he'd moved on to something else or resigned or whatever. And I think it's just at the stage now where, you know, how can any work be getting done in that place for helping children, young people? I know we say the Department for Education, but actually they cover a lot of stuff. How can anything be getting done? Coutinho, I'm not sure if that's the right pronunciation, but has now gone from being Minister for Children, Families and Wellbeing to being Secretary of State for Energy or whatever it is. I don't see the connection. You know, this has been dubbed as a promotion. How is energy more important than children, families and wellbeing? I'm done with this shizzle now, I'm afraid. Just done with it.
Michael, can I ask you then that you talked about having reached out in terms of, you know, sort of petitioning and asking and requesting the government in terms of the an adoption apology.
Yeah.
What has been the response? I mean, we'll get to why an apology, but we'll start with the call.
It's been fairly bland, effectively, that if you read the government's response to the Joint Committee on Human Rights report, that was published in March this year. Effectively, the response is just the same every time, that whether you're writing in kind of the letter that I did was quite extensive, kind of outlining the source of evidence and where they should look in their own back garden for all these bits of information. I got, you know, the standard boilerplate template response, which was just very dissatisfying in a way that it was just rebuffing back to the apology. And that's happened time and again, that other people have sort of emailed me out of the blue, or other campaign organizations have sent the same thing. It's just word for word the same. And it's very disheartening that there's not an open, frank, or a potential avenue almost to have this conversation again in light of the evidence. It's just sort of a complete blank on being able to move forwards. And it's demoralizing, but frustrating in full measure that there's a large critical mass. You know, there's a major inquiry that's come out and said there should be an apology, and just unwilling to listen. And
yeah,
that's the position that I'm hoping that the replacement minister can maybe revisit, rethink, at least open a door on, you know, yeah, see what's happening in Wales and Scotland. But again, I'm not wildly optimistic at this stage.
Do you think then that, because we can see that, I mean, if we're thinking of terms of children's ministers just being like puppets, just sort of put in position as placeholders while they move on to the next job, is it because there's a behind that, there's someone or there's something or there's a movement or an opinion that says we're not apologizing, and the best minister in the world is going to kind of butt up against that which is behind him?
Yeah, completely. I mean, the conversation just having about how individual ministers can exert an influence, and the last time you're thinking about it happening, and yeah, they definitely do crop up, but it has to be someone perhaps who's invested with the role and wants to kind of make their mark and take it forward and do whatever else. But I think your assessment is absolutely right. I think ultimately, without that political will or kind of putting themselves on the line, if they're kind of towing the party line, looking at promotion opportunity, all those other things, that ultimately they are kind of inhibited by that and looking at that rather than thinking about the issues in them and their own right.
But I guess as well, I mean, you know, it's not very well saying that it's the Department for Education that would, you know, come up with this. I don't know. I'm just kind of thrashing this out in my head while I'm talking, so that's probably not a good thing. But ultimately, it has to come from a leader or somebody, yeah, who, you know, and I you know, there's been mention of apologies about other things. And I'm not 100% sure on which countries have apologized, but I know Scotland has, obviously, because, you know, I'm Scottish and I did hear that one. But, you know, there's other nations as well, isn't there? Have Wales and...
Yeah, Wales have. Yeah. Wales, yeah, did it in April earlier on this year. Yeah. Then Australia, I think, is the big one, 10 years, yeah, ago, coming, yeah, out and kind of taking, yeah, that forward.
And of course, living with Ireland, I seem to recall, and this is my really bad memory, but I seem to recall there was an apology over the mother and baby scandals, you know, from years ago as well. But this has to come from the top, really, in terms of that kind of, I guess, yes, this is what happened, but how have these other nations come to this conclusion that they should apologize and England hasn't? I you know, that's quite a confusing thing, isn't it? Considering, yeah, there was no independent governments then. There was no Scottish assembly. There was no Welsh assembly.
That for me is exactly the nail on the head. And that's what I, in no certain terms, said effectively at the, well, yeah, you can imagine at the time that the government responsible and the apologies that Wales has gotten put forward and taken action and all the rest of it, it's a positive step. But until Westminster steps up and says, ultimately, we were the ones holding the reins of power at the time, we were responsible for decisions made in those countries at that time, it's a half apology. It's only kind of going a step towards it because they had the authority to do so.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're a historian and that's your research is historical. But what's your gut feeling that what is actually behind a lack of apology? Do you think there is is there a couple of things you can put your finger on or hypothesize about what is the crux of the issue?
I think a lot of it is like with the other scandals that have taken place in recent history, a lot of it's boiling down to the idea that there's going to be financial or legal consequences for apologising, effectively by other people claiming compensation for the harm caused or other things. So, you know, with the child migration, there was a compensation package scheme, and that's what's being wrangled about now in terms of Factor VIII, you know, the contaminated blood scandal. So I think they're worried that by doing that, they will concede that element, even though I would say that's not in the forefront of campaigners' minds by and large. But it's something that I think is going to be sat in the back of their minds. I also think there's an element that they're going to have to look at what is taking place now, in essence, that a lot of the same organizations that were doing it then, deeply implicated, either religious or voluntary or charitable in that third sector, they're the same organizations. And a lot of them are being very resistant to opening their records. A lot of them are resistant to looking at their practice. And I think, especially in the current context where the Conservative government's family values, they're pushing within social work about permanent placements earlier on and as quick as they can. And the fact that so-called non-consensual adoptions are still currency in England, despite what the EU may say, that ultimately, if they're meaningful about taking this action forward, then they're going to have to start looking at the present. Even if it's not immediately what they're going for, there are enough similarities and lines of connection that they have to think about it. And I think it opens too many present issues to then take a lot of that forward.
That's really interesting, because I've been sort of pondering about you coming on and thinking, well, I sort of felt that there was a, firstly, we put a call out for questions and silence was the stern reply.
I'm not sure what that says.
Well, we got one from Car Crash Princess, who you probably follow on Twitter, and she got a good question, which we will get to definitely. But I wondered, because I guess our listenership is, if from an adoption world, it's probably adopters. And I just thought whether there's this kind of slight unease from adoptive parents going, well, hang on, if we put a flag up and say, yeah, that adoption's wrong, then do we have to ask questions about the adoption that we're party to? And do you think that is probably is that part of that there's a reluctance to for people to look at current adoption?
I'd say it's difficult. I'd say there's two elements to it as well. I think you're right that there is clearly a personal kind of positional point of view, which is inevitable in something like this when you start digging through and thinking about it, that says that how does that affect my intentions, my motivations, my reason for doing things as well. But it's for me, the bigger policy dynamic that I'm more interested in effectively about the underpinning ways that happens, how it's done in law, how it affects social work, all those other bits and pieces as well. But I think that's the key almost, that if you really start asking about that yes, the way that adoption has changed quite significantly and the processes and mechanisms kind of legislatively use all those kind of day-to-day things, but a lot of the underlying principles and purposes of it are still comparable enough that it raises a lot of concerns.
Well, that's maybe a good moment then for you to could you give us a whistle stop tour of the research, just I'm sure that it's probably a Reith lecture, isn't it, in it, but really give us an understanding, because I think I'd always, if you'd have asked me, say, 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years ago, said, oh, well, what was society's, why were forced adoptions happening in 1965? Yeah. I would have said, well, society took the view that that young mums shouldn't be single mums, and that families didn't want to bring shame on them or shame on their children or stigma and all of that. And so actually these organizations facilitated that. But that's one side of the coin, isn't it?
Yeah, completely like that. So I don't want to downplay the social side and the attitude and the sort of cultural dynamic. I think there is a very strong element of that. And you can see that across time. You know, if you go back to the origins of the poor laws back in the Elizabethan periods, about how, you know, parish relief and support was done in those days as well, the same kind of social stigma is really kind of right through the way. You know, it's hundreds of years old. So I don't want to downplay that and the way this relates to the laws and everything else. But why adoption, I think you can't say just society alone, is because adoption starts for a very particular set of reasons. It's then carried through, it's expanded again for a particular set of reasons, and it's closed and stopped and reduced and changed. Again, those reasons aren't in society, people's attitudes alone. A lot of it's being driven by policy, by government, by legislation, by practice as well. And so that for me is the key thing that you can see when you start looking at this, the kind of the records side, that it's that change, that adoption comes along at a particular moment in time. And even how a lot of the big voluntary organizations involved, how they do things changes. So like mother and baby homes, you kind of conjure up in your head this kind of almost like this maudlin laundry kind of image, in a way that before adoption really took off in 1926, so like before the Second World War, which started in 1939, it was very, very small. Like the numbers of people adopted were a few thousand nationwide, primarily in the Southeast, but across the country. And that's because there was a sense that it was that there was a worry amongst adoptive parents that effectively, because eugenics was very popular at the time as well, that children carried some kind of issue or contagion. There was a real reluctance to do that. Mm. So understandings of childhood changed during the war, that these kind of eugenic ideas, not surprisingly, with the circumstances of the Nazis, start to go out of fashion. The new ideas of childhood really came into being, particularly, I don't know if John Bowlby is the big name, mm. the idea of maternal deprivation. He wrote a major report for the World Health Organization, but also published this really popular Penguin paperback published in the thousands that loads of social workers from that whole post-war period would have had on their bookshelves. And his ideas were very influential. And it may seem counterintuitive to say a man who comes up with the idea of attachment, maternal deprivation, pushing for adoption. But his view is that children were damaged. They could become delinquents if they didn't have a stable home. And this idea that unmarried mothers would become unstable potentially in the future was the big concern, and that it's best to act now, it's best to act preventively. And that was his reason for acting. So kind of going back to my early bit about mother and baby homes, they changed completely. So originally, mother and baby homes, they were designed to train mothers to keep their kids, because you carried the stigma, you carried the shame with you. It was about learning how to become a domestic servant, because, you know, it's hard work and people didn't really want to tolerate unmarried women in their homes. So you get a job as domestic, you could live somewhere as well. You've got a house and a roof over your head. That's what they were trained to do. And then during the Second World War, as you get a lot of, you know, people entering into marriages in a very short time or not, with the expectation that they might, adoption, the real push for it expands enormously, as it did after the First World War. And all of a sudden, mother and baby homes go from training women to keep their kids to these domestic skills, their very gendered, very kind of sexist way of doing it, through to the idea of adoption as a solution, as a way that had been in the background taking place. But all of a sudden, there was a real shift in how it took place. And you can see, again, the social attitude, by and large, it's similar. It's not changed overnight. But the whole reasons how it's done, they change. And they change as a result of the war, but also because the government starts funding it effectively. And that's the big thing. There's a major, very, it's very tedious, very bureaucratic, but there's a government circular where they send out instructions to local authorities. And this circular said, you need to start paying voluntary organizations or run your own baby homes for these purposes. And that's really when it took off from 1943 onwards.
And that's quite a key moment then, isn't it? Because it's the difference between it being, it's a moment where they say, well, actually, we're going to put up some money for this because we think that this is science-based. It's social. Well, that's a big question of social work, isn't it? Is it social engineering? Is it social control? Is it all of those things? But it's, and so it was, it is this coin, isn't it? That society said, yeah, we agree with that. And the government said, well, we're going to put money into it. And it's chicken and egg. Is it chicken and egg? Am I oversimplifying that?
No, I'd say it's government first, mainly because that pressure is always there, that kind of stigma, that judgment. But there's another side to that coin that a lot of social historians, you know, studying everyday working class life, you know, from the Victorian period right through to the present day, there was a lot more unmarried parents and cohabiting couples who effectively, for all intents and purposes, were husband and wife and, you know, would present themselves to the public as that, but weren't. That was very, very common. It was the idea that it's unmarried mothers, and particularly and usually very, very young ones. And that was the key change, that it went from a kind of demographic that was being affected by the kids, effectively by the age, both of the mothers, but then also of the children they were having.
But that's really, I mean, as you're saying, and I had not really connected this, my same grandmother who'd gone to the National Assistance Board, she'd got pregnant as a teenager, but she'd been sort of taken away. But there was no, adoption was not an issue. She was, she went and actually, as you say, she went and learned how to be a maid. She actually married the father, who then subsequently died a few years later. So actually I find myself quite, I'm gonna have to go away and ask some questions of some relatives and see if I can make sense of that. But that's really interesting, because actually if that had been 20 years later, if that had been 1945 or 1955, it would have been a totally different outcome.
Yeah, completely. And so you've got to bear in mind, it doesn't happen sort of overnight. There's a real kind of post-war panic, effectively, that the unmarried mothers could upset, you know, stable family life. And there's a real investment to doing that. Obviously, that didn't happen. And then there's a steady but kind of noticeable increase in this kind of type of adoption, effectively, for I have no kin relation at all. And it just creeps and creeps and creeps. So the peak year is 1968. And it's basically an upward curve from 1943, apart from a slight blip from the 47, 48, when it kind of goes up and comes down. But it's just a steady increase right the way through. So it's just incrementally growing and growing and growing as the kind of capacity and the willingness in terms of the state, in terms of the organization involved to do this really grows, because the money of it is becoming available. It comes routinized that, you know, you hear this in the people's experiences they share with the committee or other people who've said, you know, that I may have told a GP or a school teacher and they put me in touch with the moral welfare worker or the local authority. It becomes a very familiar story. And it becomes a very familiar story because that's what the policy kind of apparatus was there to do, almost, to kind of say, this, okay, we know the problem that you are presenting. You've got a whole policy to deal with this. This is the route that you can go effectively. And put yourself in the shoes of being young, of being kind of not knowing, being often deferential authority at this particular time, that people know your best interests. You can possibly do this. And then also either your parents, because of that social pressure, or often there's a case, social workers, medical officials, others applying pressure on parents, it becomes a very familiar tale. But it's a case of not, it's just one-off tale. It's a private story, just a family story. You multiply that time and time again, you get the same picture emerging. It's not an accident. It's because that's a conscious decision that's been taken, or a set of decisions.
And I mean, sorry, Scott.
I'm surprised you remembered I was still here, Al, to be honest with you. I wanted to ask a bit of a question going back to the points that are made about, you know, the societal thing that we all thought was, and it's not about blaming or accusing or anything like that, but I'm just wondering, especially like living in Ireland, the mother and baby homes and stuff, how much religion played a part in this as well? Because, you know, thinking back, the Church of England, again, not blaming the Church of England for anything, but I'm thinking also about LGBT stuff. And yeah, they do tend to have quite an influence on stuff like this. And do you think, or did you find evidence that that was kind of a contributing factor as well? Or was it not really of any relevance?
Just, I mean, this is the point where you're kind of very studied and staid academic, provide a very complex answer. But yes, yes, that's exactly the case. It's just a simple yes. So the reason that the church, both the Catholic Church and the Church of England, were major players in this is because, again, in 1943, 1944, when the National Health Service was being considered about what we're going to do, there was a conversation had about whether they should nationalize mother and baby homes effectively, because they wanted the service to be provided. They were taking hospitals and everything else. Why not mother and baby homes? And the Church of England, along with the Catholic Church and the officials in the Ministry of Health, they all sit down. The church kind of put a lot of pressure on that this is a moral issue, it's a religious issue, you can't take it away from us effectively. And they kick up a stink. They don't end up nationalizing, but they still end up using them effectively. And so even though some local authorities have their own mother and baby homes that become these places for adoption, so particularly big ones like Birmingham, London, Manchester, Liverpool, well, Liverpool's a religious exception, but they all start providing them. But it's mainly religious organizations that do this. And they survive through financial support by local authorities and central government in doing it. And they're advocating for it, they're maintaining these kind of things. But equally, the church, it's like the NHS, it's not one thing, it's many things. So it's done on a kind of a local level by diocese. And there's differences, like important differences between what happens in England, the Church of England versus Church of Scotland. And then again, Northern Ireland is a slightly different case. But in every instance, that the different church faith organizations, so it's not just moral welfare. You know, you've got the Salvation Army, you've got the Church Army, all those kind of charitable, quasi-religious, evangelical organizations involved, effectively, and they're a main player in sustaining it. So when the ministry starts having discussions about should they wind things down, should they change policy, they're lobbying constantly to say, you know, we need to improve this, continue it, expand it. Unmet demand for our homes. We can't take as many more. Please give us more money. That all kind of thing. And that's done both locally, like lobbying local authorities, but also by big religious figures lobbying central government.
Interesting. Oh.
And it is. And so as part of the request for an apology, has there been a reaching out to those faith organizations? Because the Church of England is the state religion, technically. How relevant that is now, I don't know. But they still have have the synod, they have a, you know, they all are. We also have the Catholic the Catholic churches which were involved. I think you'd mentioned them, but
yeah,
have is there any idea of how receptive they are to that? Because you've got parachurch organizations. In the last podcast, we talked about Home for Good. I'm not going to go there. We're not going to open that can of worms.
Nope.
But church, so actually, has there been any sort of
communication? Yeah, so the Catholic Church apologized 2016, 17, some years ago, they made an apology, but I would say it was very vapid because it said sorry. It's like the government now. They say sorry without saying sorry. In effect, that they came out and said, we apologize. These things happened to you, different values at the time. And there was no consequent action from that about exploring their own organization. You know, I've tried to access those records. No is the short answer. There's been no real impact of that apology on the people affected, or a way of being more transparent about what, to what extent they were involved in the process. And the only reason I know about it is because their papers, like individual bishops' papers, contain a lot of information about lobbying. But also, again, within central government, those central government papers have significant numbers of exchanges and meetings between senior figures. And you can see one side of the exchange, but not the other.
And so when the specific wording of that, then when we say sorry this happened to you, it do you think that it's maybe that there's a corporate kind of forgetfulness, amnesia, going, oh, looking back, oh, it was terrible, it was the 60s, everyone was high as kites, or is it, do you think that they need to do their due diligence and go, hang on, let's have a look, our fingers were in this pie and we need to apologize for that? Is it as simple as that? I'm making it all simple.
I think it's about making it meaningful that you can say sorry, but not being sorry. And that's what they've done effectively, because it's not just about the words, it's about the actions that are then taken as a result of that. And that's kind of beyond my, you know, horizons and my legitimate stuff that I do as an academic researcher. But that's where that should take place. And that just simply hasn't happened.
Yeah. Because that was going to be my question was, I mean, apology, if it's made, when it's made, it seems like it should be made, and I think that eventually it will be made, but, you know, by whatever government that is, who can tell? But after the apology is made, what changes? You know, I mean, I know that this isn't your kind of thing, but, or this isn't your field specifically, but what you know, you must have a small idea of what people would want from the apology or after the apology, or not.
To a point. I mean, I think I'm not the person necessarily to speak with authority on that, in a way that I think mainly the platform should be given over to those with lived experience primarily, and about the kind of the kind of requests and demands that they're going for, and how they then press that forward. But I think my role is to kind of provide the backdrop, almost the first step in that, in saying that the kind of archival evidence that is there that backs up what you're saying and how you're saying it should be taken forward. That's the kind of foot in the door almost, and what happened beyond that, I think, is a little bit beyond my because I'm not associated or kind of implicated in it, that I wouldn't know how they want to take that forward.
Yeah, because I guess it also makes you think about this kind of tradition, which we hear about in England a lot, about, you know, access to records and people really struggling to access their own records and stuff. And I know that is a big issue in Ireland as well, where, you know, there's kind of legal rights for the birth parent or birth mother, predominantly birth mother. I mean, I'm sure it applies to birth parents, where the child, or the child that was adopted, should I say, is... They don't have any rights to see their files, and in the UK, you know, they have to go to this person or that person to be thinking. So I guess, you know, it's all very well with an apology, but actually, what are we going to do to be able to make sure that these people who were affected by that are actually able to find out, you know, about that page in the book, that, or those dozen pages in the book that have been torn out for them.
Completely. I think that's exactly it. In a way, you hear about those really difficult stories about trying to piece back together your own identity, and the real gatekeeping and difficulties that take place as a result of that, not necessarily on an individual level, because that's how the system works. And I know there are a lot of demands and pressure around that. I think the thing that I would like most from it is that conversation and the difficulty that goes with it, in a sense of that feeling of relinquishment, that I was given up, I was surrendered, I was
Yeah.
You know, there was no love there at all. And
yeah,
I don't know how that is to feel in that kind of experiential side of it. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine, but I don't know. And being able to say on the historical record, the kind of recognized one, we can say the amount of coercion, pressure, in some instances, violence that's then applied as a result of that, that's an historical record. And it allows people to see what happened in a different light that puts yourself in the shoes of those impacted by it. And for me, that's the most important thing, I think, that can be added by an apology from my point of view in changing the record there, alongside the kind of requests and demands of those with lived experience that are campaigning for the broader gains as a result.
Yeah, because you mentioned at the beginning that perhaps the fear is that financial implications, that there's going to be some sort of class action suit. But actually, I've never heard anyone, I can't think of any instance where I've heard people saying, oh, I want compensation. People are often talking about, I want an apology and I want my records. I want to know the truth.
I'd say, to kind of dig the knife in further to the extent of government involvement, that the exception to that is the use of sildestrol. You know, the drug whereby kind of dried up mothers' breast milk early on, deeply carcinogenic. And there has been in Scotland an action as a result of that, because a lot of people, unfortunately, have died prior to even coming to that. But I think that's not forced adoption immediate in the same bit. It's specifically around the use of the drug. Obviously, the two are linked, but that's where the quest has come from.
I'd not heard that. I didn't know whether you had, Scott, about the use of forced medication.
So it's an estrogen drug. In fact, they use in Australia. And if you read through their inquiry report about the widespread and harmful use of it effectively, but initially, this is how damaging, so this is Australia rather than England, that they were injecting it into mothers during childbirth. And the reason they stopped doing it to them during childbirth, because they knew it was harmful. They didn't want to hurt the child. So they kept on doing it to the mothers, well, full knowing, as they did across the world at that time in the 50s, that it was causing all sorts of very harmful side effects, but they didn't want it to impact the children. And that became apparent quite early on there. Now, unfortunately, that there is a tranche of files in the UK covering that similar period, but they're all closed. So I've not had access to them. So stuff that I've looked at is the very medico-scientific stuff from the Medical Research Council, stuff like that. So it's kind of trying to come at the same subject from a different angle. There is material, I just can't look at it.
Yeah, I think I've probably mentioned it on the podcast before, but I worked when I first qualified, which was 2000 and it was 10 years ago. Actually, 10 years ago yesterday, I qualified.
You've done the same job for 10 years. Imagine if you were a children's minister.
I tell you, I'm on fire. I worked for an agency that was formerly a Catholic, the Catholic care agency, so it did fostering and adoption, and they employed someone 20 hours a week, and his job was literally, he used to come to work in his overalls, he was a social worker, and he'd come, and he would go, I've got a letter, and he'd go, right, I'm going to go, and he would spend a day in a loft, in a basement, behind walls, and he would dig out he was a great guy, and he took it so seriously. But that, I don't know whether that's the exception or the rule, and lots of agencies, the agencies that were present in 1970 and maybe not the ones that are present now, and where have those records gone? And it just feels like an open wound for so many people.
Yeah, completely. And I think part of it is trying to then track, part of it's difficult in tracking down where your history is, in a way that knowing that you were adopted isn't enough, in a sense that you then have to know whereabouts and which organization is, and the kind of the constellation of organizations, big, great, and small, and in between, means that the amount of onus that's placed on you to go looking for it effectively. Whereas a lot of the actions taking place in Australia has been about centralizing everything so that you can access your information much more readily and learn about that, rather than having to know it all in advance and be kind of passed from pillar to post because it was some quasi-evangelical small minority organization we're trying to home for 18 months. And they do unfortunately happen.
Yeah, because I mean that's quite a big thing, isn't it? Adopted people are expected to do all the work.
Yeah,
and the people who have been adopted, they didn't ask to be adopted. To expect them to then chase and try and find out. And I think that's probably where programs like Long Lost Family have come about, because people were saying, I can't find. I can't find any record of myself beyond this day. I know I was adopted, or I know that this, all that sort of stuff. So, but then for them to have to then go and do all that work, that's minimizing their history for a start. But we're also
compounding their pain.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's madness. And you know, I think like if Australia was able to do that and set a precedent, you know, I know we can't change the past, and I get that. And you know, as sad as it is, but if we can change the future in the here and now by doing something really, you know, really kind of, I don't want to use the word out of the box, but you know, kind of just admit that you got it wrong, and we're going to do this as a not as a solution, because there's no solution to it, but as a way of being able to, so that you don't have to do all the hard work. We you know, and if we don't have the information, then you know, that's kind of another issue. But it's just I've just had a little mini rant there, I think.
Well, rather than can I remind you, Scott, of the interview in the year, we've not released it yet. We had an interview with Bernardo's in Ireland.
Yes, we did. Yes, you're right.
And their role is basically restorative for families. Mm-hmm. It's a permanent open door to support families or adult adoptees. And I think we'll put this out maybe the week after. That would be really good to do this, and people can listen to see what the actions that they've taken. Can I ask a question, Michael? So as we've talked, I, as an adoptive parent, I felt quite uncomfortable with some of this, because it's part of my, you know, I can't pretend it's not, you know, I'm not an adoptive parent. I'd like to think that there was sort of some point in time where there was a clean break and we went, oh, no, we're going to be much more ethical. But I'm suspecting that you're going to tell me there's not.
I am.
All right, you are. Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
Right.
Because that's how did that moment adoption end? So if I've said, you know, there was this moment in time when there was a series of decisions taken that led to it happening and then it stopping, there are social things taking place, right? So access to birth control is enormous. Access to reproductive rights through, it's still through medical opinion, it's still technically legal, but abortion is a big element as well. Changes in divorce law as well are quite big, because one, you'd be surprised, but one of the common elements is people having second families as well, because they can't divorce because it's so expensive, effectively, that changes in law there allow you to do that. It just changes the way that families are then created and reconstructed in Britain. So there are a lot of social things taking place. I don't want to downplay them. You need to recognize them. They're important, changing attitudes as well as kind of reflecting them. What happens as a result of this is that the kind of made-to-measure babies almost are kind of the supply of children for adoption dries up, because the ideal adoptee from the point of view of the system, so to speak, is a baby, preferably a girl, between 10 days old and 6 weeks. That's when parents want them, because it allows the adoptive family to kind of put off this idea of a stable nuclear family to the public, that it's kind of as any other family would be. And it also, this is in the eyes of the kind of state and social workers, it allows the birth mother then to kind of start her proper life separately. You've been rehabilitated, you can go on and do that. So that starts to wind down. What happens is that existing organizations repurpose what they do. So this is where, again, it's a lovely series in the government archives about Thomas Corum getting in touch with the government and changing what they do. So they then start reorganizing around providing adoption placements for disabled children, particularly so-called hard-to-place children.
Yeah.
This is when you also get Bernardo's in the late 1960s putting on a so-called mixed-race adoption unit, where that's what they start to do. So this is where the care system and adoption really start to come together. So local authorities had been doing this, but because you could almost have, like I said, these so-called made-to-measure babies available, there were very, very few of them being adopted in quite the same way. So local authorities become more involved. A lot of the organizations either step back or are nationalized eventually as a result of the 76 Act and start doing other elements. The other big growth area, you get a shift from, again, so-called made-to-measure to deprived children going through the care system. So demographic changes from being these younger children to slightly older children as well. And it's the same apparatus, the same institutional arrangement, recognizing this shift. And this is also international. There's a lot of literature about this, which is slightly beyond my area of expertise, because I do the British welfare state, is where international adoption, inter-country adoption really becomes a big growth industry, both here, but also Canada, USA, across the Western world. That's when it really takes off after sort of the middle of the 1970s because of this change. So you've got to bear in mind all of those dynamics as well.
Yeah. Because I think that it is an uncomfortable conversation as an adoptive parent. And I was talking to a friend of mine just this afternoon. She's around the house. And adoptions, you know, by comparison to 1968, which was, what was it, 28,000, something like that, mid-20s, late high 20s, we're down
to 16,000 at its height.
We're down now to 3,000, give or take, yeah. bit more. And I think that as an adoptive parent, I don't know, Scott, what do you think? How do you feel about adoption now? Michael, what do you think about adoption now?
I mean, it's a major, I can't sort of answer it in the same way I did with the church, you know, like yes or no. But I think you've got, for me as a historian, I always see those continuities. Don't get me wrong, like I said, there are elements of change, and you know, beyond what happened in 76, like obviously the subsequent changes as well, and how adoption is done, what it's for, and how it's managed. And there are those elements of change, but you can still see the continuities underneath them about the notions that there are right kinds of family and wrong kinds of family. And that's effectively what it's saying, in essence, that children need to be rescued or salvaged from these wrong kind of families, and they are judged by the state, by government, by neglect or abuse, or how that's defined and understood, or whatever particular reason. And there are these right families that they can be rescued and dropped into. And I think ultimately, that's the model that it's rooted in to an extent that has much longer kind of Victorian origins with the kind of the NSPCC, the child migration movement as well, the bigger associations. But you can see those ways of thinking and understanding. And I don't want to impugn anyone's motives necessarily, because it's something, again, I used to teach social workers. Everyone gets into it for the progressive values rather than for the money, right? I mean, no one goes thinking, oh, I'm going to be a director of social services in 10 years, I'll be on a retirement pension. But there's always a difference between that motivation for getting into and doing something and the system, which are the system of, like, of laser forces and policies and legislation it's a part of. And it's a very difficult reconciliation between the two, because it asks those and poses them very difficult and uncomfortable questions.
Scott, what do you think about adoption now?
Well, I have been thinking about this a lot since Michael agreed to come on, actually, because I think I generally do anyway. I think about it a lot, but my opinion and views on it have changed a lot over the years, actually. And I think back even in the lifetime of this podcast, we started this podcast in 2016, I think. And I think sometimes, not very often, but sometimes I do go back and listen to some episodes. And I just think, how wet behind the lugs were we in terms of our language, our terminology, all that sort of stuff. And bear in mind, I mean, I was working at Adoption UK then. And for me at that point in time, the priority working at Adoption UK was supporting other parents. Fine. Granted, that's what I was there to do. That was my job. That was within my, you know, my job titles and stuff. But as I've come away from that and kind of worked more, you know, we have the conversations on the podcast as well. And what struck me when we started doing them was listening. So not hearing, but actually listening to people's experiences of being adopted. And I think that's what's changed my view now. I love all three of my kids dearly. Absolutely. Wouldn't change them for the world. They're here and, you know, I support them. But what I'm very conscious of is all of the kind of things that I listen to where, you know, things like the people who are adopted not feeling that they can go and look for their birth families until their adoptive parents have died, or, you know, all that kind of stuff that really resonates with me, because I would never in any life would I have adopted somebody and thought that's how they would feel 20, 30 years later, that they had to wait on me dying to go and, you know, look out their history and what those pages of the book that we're talking about that have been ripped out. So my view on it has changed quite a lot, actually, over the years. And, you know, do I agree with it? I think I still would say yes to that. But I just think that there's lots of different things that could be done a lot differently. You know, today we got an email from somebody asking why a certain regional adoption agency didn't include a certain thing in their training or their support. And that's kind of stuff that, you know, is really important to these adopted people, so that, you know, it's not a savior thing anymore. And it never should have been about that. But what I'm saying is, you know, I think that there is an element of that within adoption, not just in the UK, all over the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's difficult to come away from that. It is absolutely difficult to come away from that. Even if you don't think you're doing it, you probably are in some way. So, you know, it's... Oh, listen to me, Randy McRant face again.
I think we need, and your Michael, your research should be sort of, it should be like day one, lesson one of preparation for adopters. If this is, this is what you're getting, you know, this is that all of these historic policies and societal kind of where they merge and how they interact gets us to today. So even things like you were talking about Bowlby, and I think Anna Freud's in the middle of all that about how these little babies that we need to sever the relationship with their biological parent, and then we need to imprint them onto the new. That kind of is still, it's still there. It's maybe not, those words wouldn't be used, but the practice has all of that in it. And I think, I just find it fascinating. I don't have an answer. That's what I find really interesting.
But just, you've asked me and Michael, what about you, Al? What's your views on it?
Do
you know what? What is really interesting is I've really thought about this, and I was talking to the good Mrs. Coates, and we were saying that actually, on reflection, our children needed to not live with their biological parents. There's a full stop, right? That was not for their welfare. But actually, what legal order, you know, the severance of that link. Mm-hmm. And I think for some of my children, that was appropriate and remains appropriate. And the police have told us that's appropriate. For some of my children, with hindsight, that was just shocking for everyone involved. Mm-hmm. But I was 27. It was 2000. And I just did as I was told, which a lot of adopters do. The power dynamic is the system says, you do it like this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It takes a very headstrong, self-assured adopter to kind of go, I read a book and I'm going to do it like this.
But that's a very fascinating reflection, just in thinking about that power dynamic, even now, about as an adopter to be able to say no, or that it shouldn't be done this way, it should be done differently. That even that, with the kind of experience and background you've got, and the will to do that isn't there, then thinking about how that, on the other side of the coin, where the power dynamic is even further imbalanced, it just shows you that it's not necessarily that individual interaction, it's how the whole system plays out and its purpose. And that's what I'm saying, that there's this ideology about doing it about right families and wrong families and shifting kids, but that's realized through law, through money for different organizations, through how the whole bit fits together, and that's intentional. And that's kind of, it's very interesting to hear you reflect on that kind of that power in the decisions and the consequences they then bring for you, kids.
Yeah, well, and I think that the interesting thing is, once we, because we got lots of adopted children, which is a long story, but when we adopted the second set of children, intermittently, I'm not sure if that word works there, but we felt much more in the position of power, and we said, actually, we do want to maintain contact. We do want to have physical contact. We want to, and we were very much more led by the needs of the children as opposed to the needs of the local authority. And I just think that what I feel like I'm coming to is that actually we need to just forget the Tories. And so it was it wasn't an accident we were talking about the Tories at the beginning. And obviously you've all got jobs, so it doesn't matter to you, but Dr. Michael's a doctor. He can't be going around calling the Tories names. my thought is that in some ways the care review dropped the ball. It didn't. It just kind of went, oh, is there anything we could tweak? But actually we need a review. It feels like we need a government review of adoption that says, this is why we need an apology. This is who needs to give it. This is the this is the future message, but also this is what adoption needs to. If we're going to keep adoption, these are the bits we want to keep. These are the bits we need to ditch.
Yeah,
I'm aiming high.
You are, but maybe that's why they're not doing it, because they know how much work that is. Mm. You know,
and the consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, well,
I mean, that's been the difference between the Joint Committee on Human Rights. If you look at that, that was not a statutory inquiry. So it didn't have the same power to compel witnesses to bring, you know, invest and do all these things and try and come to a, this opinion in a way that, you know, a lot of the child abuse inquiries have. So putting something on that footing to kind of do the kind of thing you're saying would be a step towards it. But I think there'd be a reluctance to do that because of the consequences if they were kind of handled in a meaningful way, in an independent arm's length way, rather than one that can be controlled or ignored, as in the case with the JCHR report.
I mean, it feels like it's, there's maybe a moment now where we could start to lobby the potential new government. It seems like there's a, maybe a window of opportunity that we could have something. We've got a year, maybe. And so has, do you know of any move to kind of twist Labour's arm? Is Helen Hayes still, there's been a reshuffle again, hasn't there? Yeah. Is Helen Hayes still the children's minister? Shadow minister?
Yeah, I checked today. She announced it in all her glory on her social media that she'd been retained rather than dumped.
Excellent.
But well, at least there's some consistency then.
We've had her on the podcast. She was lovely, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was good, actually. Yeah.
I think she was slightly suspicious of us. On reflection,
she's clearly listened to too many podcasts.
she's got someone else to listen to. Yeah, Michael, that's been fascinating, and I feel like
absolutely.
I feel like this would. I'd love to have a pint with you, and have a. We could really unpick all of this because it feels like there's so much more to discover
just,
and unpick.
Yeah,
yes.
I was just going to say, Michael, a pint for Al is a pint of squash because a pint of anything else, he would be a mess. So just putting that out there, just in case that should ever happen, it's literally a pint of squash, and that's it. Yeah.
I mean, a forewarning as well that if I bring my computer, you'd just be wall to wall me showing you document after document after document. I've done that more than one occasion, so you know, it cuts both ways.
That's fair enough.
He'll be asleep by the time you get the laptop out. So don't worry about that.
terrible.
Michael, it's funny though.
I think it's been really fascinating, and it's really made me think about. I guess the one thing it has made me think about what it means to be an ally, because actually, that it feels like, what is allyship, and are we well? Is there a place for our allyship, or do we just need to keep quiet? And not, I don't know. Mm. That's maybe a bigger question. I mean, you would be considered, Michael, as an ally of adopted adults, adult adoptees.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd say perhaps inadvertently so, but that's not the reason that I came into it. I came into it, like I said at the beginning, very naively, that I was going through records. And when you start to piece together the jigsaw on the scale that, very tedious thing, my PhD thesis is 140 pages long, by the way, so you know, that will certainly help you go to sleep. But on the scale that I have done, and you can sort of see it, and the organization, the orchestration behind it, I'm left in absolutely no doubt about where the kind of the right side of history is. And then I think that leaves me with a responsibility to do something about it, having seen it.
And so that's why. I mean, I was thinking that's really tricky, isn't it? Because you kind of opened up a folder one day and it's kind of turned your life in a slightly different direction, hasn't it?
As someone who normally does financial relationships in the National Health Service in the 1980s, yes, it has.
That sounds like a page turner.
I won't be sending you a review copy then.
With all due respect, that sounds terrible.
Each to their own, Al.
Yes. Come on. For every Jack, there's a Jill and all that.
Yeah, stop being judgmental.
I'll stop being judgmental. Day one of social work. Well, Michael, thank you so much. And I really appreciate it. And what we'll do is you've sent us through some documentation and where you've given evidence and some information about how you got to where you got to and stuff like that. So we'll put that in the show notes as well, because that is really interesting. There's a lot of reading there, but I think it's really worth, if people want to, you know, accost their priest in the street, go tooled up with all of that, or their MP.
Say things like that.
Well, we shouldn't accost priests in the street.
No, I'm just saying, don't encourage people to do it. I mean, you know, anyway.
I can't remember the last time I saw a priest in the street.
If you go to Liverpool, there's quite a lot getting on the bus, you know, Stephen now.
To be fair, I live in Ireland, Jess. You do see priests in the street. So, right. You're right. Anyway.
Excellent. Yeah. That's fair enough. Michael, thank you so much for your time. Scott, thank you so much for your time. And I both wish you well on this September evening. Bon Jovi.
Anchovy.
Thank you.